As I said before, there's not going to be any breaks, so I hope my very good friend Taylor Branch will come forward, and Bill Shambra, who's also my good friend, will come forward, and Joe Eldridge, who will be moderating this program, will come forward.
My name is Joe Eldridge, and I am the university chaplain at American University, and I kind of live here. My office is downstairs. This is an interfaith space, which is a tribute to the visionaries 40 years ago, a Methodist president and a Jewish businessman who conspired to imagine creating an interfaith space at this university. The leitmotif of this building is hospitality and welcome. Now, that's commonplace for us. It's routine. We don't think a thing about it. However, I often have the opportunity to welcome visiting delegations from Africa, from Asia, from around the world, and of journalists and professionals and academics, and they are absolutely stunned by the fact that we all occupy the very same space. This building is at different times a synagogue, a temple, a sanctuary, a mosque, and we take it for granted. But it is a stunning example, I think, for some of our brothers and sisters around the world to realize that we can live and have our being in the same place. I want to thank Curtis Gans for this opportunity to moderate this panel. The topic is one certainly that captivates me and has riveted the media and the public. Indicative of that was the first question asked to David Broder. Religion has a way of popping up all the time in our newspapers and in our media. Was it a couple of days ago that we read about the discovery of the Gospel of Judas? And it made the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times. The fact that it comes just the day or so before what for Christians is Holy Week and Passover for the Jewish community, I'm sure is just pure happenstance, pure circumstance. Sure, there wasn't any connection in the minds of the editors who placed those articles. Well, we do have a topic that is of great interest, and we have a couple of people who are going to help to guide us through the wilderness into what we hope to be some clarity and insight into this issue that challenges us all. Taylor Branch is a Southerner from Atlanta. He received the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1988 for his book, Parting the Waters, part of a trilogy. The last part of that trilogy he just finished, so he's been much prominent in the media of late as he's been talking about his book, Canaan's Edge. He has also written several other books. I'm not going to list them. He served as a columnist and editor for Esquire, Harper's, The Washington Monthly. He received a five-year MacArthur Foundation Fellowship in 1991 and National Humanities Medal from President Clinton in 1999. Just I read one a review from, I think it was USA Today, that says, 24 years, three books, 2,849 pages, and one Pulitzer Prize later, he has reached a historian's version of the Promised Land. We are glad to have him with us. William Shambra is the director of the Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philanthropy and Civic Renewal. Before coming to the Hudson Institute, he was the director of programs at the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee. Prior to that, he served as senior advisor and chief speechwriter for Attorney General Edwin Meese III. He was director of the Office of Personnel Management and secretary Constance Horner and Secretary of Health and Human Services Louis Sullivan. He is also a prolific writer and commentator, having published op-ed pieces and editorial pieces in a number of major newspapers in the country. And I have to say that in a conversation we had before the panel, I found out that his wife is studying to be a chaplain, which endears him to me. So we welcome them, and we look forward to their helping us to sort through the nexus of religion and politics in America. And I'm not sure, frankly, who wants to go first. Taylor, do you want to take
it? We haven't discussed it.
We haven't discussed it. Taylor, you want to
go first? That's fine. Sure.
Okay, great. We will we'll have a few minutes for questions following the presentation. Thank you.
It's not often I get to appear between two Pulitzer Prize winners, so I really want to sort of try to set this up. On the other hand, I'm breaking the chain of Pulitzer Prize winners, so I apologize for that. Thank you for inviting me to this inaugural event, Curtis. As he mentioned, we are indeed friends, and I hope colleagues on a number of projects going into the future. Grants flow to Bush allies on social issues, read the headline of Tom Edsel's Washington Post article from March 22, 2006. Edsel's case against the administration was that federal dollars under the faith-based initiative were in fact simply subsidizing the president's political friends. Thus, the latest version of liberalism's complaint about faith-based initiatives, that it's nothing more than a crass political ploy dreamed up by Karl Rove to appease the religious right and to buy votes from gullible African American and Hispanic religious leaders. As one skeptic noted in the article, faith-based dollars are just slush funds for conservative interest groups. These organizations would not be in existence if it were not for the federal dollars coming through. The Edsel article featured a photo of the president embracing one Bishop Sedgwick Daniels, pastor of Holy Redeemer Institutional Church of God in Christ, Milwaukee's largest African-American congregation. Holy Redeemer had received over $1.5 million in 2003 and 2004 in faith-based funding, and clearly no coincidence in Edsel's view, Bishop Daniels had been a delegate to the 2004 Republican National Convention. There it is, slam dunk evidence that the faith-based initiatives program is nothing more than a political payoff. Or is it? As it turns out, I know something about that photograph and the path President Bush took to reach Bishop Daniels' church. Some attention to that story might clarify for us the thought that went into faith-based initiatives, the founder's intentions for that initiative, so to speak, and it has little to do with partisan corruption. I met Bishop Daniels in the mid-90s when I was a program officer at Milwaukee's Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation. Those of you who follow the conspiratorial theories of conservative power in America will recognize that name because it's frequently cited as a prime funding source for the vast right-wing conspiracy that has today kidnapped American politics. To be sure, the foundation does indeed fund many conservative think tanks and scholars. But to me, the most interesting part of Bradley's work was our effort to live out in our own urban backyard one of conservatism's central convictions, the notion that political authority should flow away from large centralized government bureaucracies and back to local community institutions like the family, neighborhood, house of worship, the school around the corner, and small ethnic and voluntary associations. Within these small local mediating structures, as the sociologists describe them, Americans had traditionally reared and educated their young according to their own moral standards, provided love and care for the vulnerable, and satisfied their yearning for belonging, rootedness, and community. According to this view, bureaucratic centralization's chief crime was not restricting free markets. After all, markets will always figure out a way to make a buck, even or perhaps especially in the era of big government, as should be apparent by now. The chief problem was that as federal agencies assumed responsibility for social and educational tasks from local governments and voluntary associations, those institutions withered and died, leaving more problems than ever unsolved and resulting in a net increase in human misery. As Nathan Glaser summarized what he called the limits of social policy, our efforts to deal with distress are themselves increasing distress. One longtime Bradley grantee, Robert Woodson, founder of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, argues that this dynamic had brought particular devastation to America's low-income communities. Within his own African-American community, he notes, families, businesses, and neighborhoods had survived the worst years of segregation and Jim Crow largely intact. Only in recent decades had they gone into steep decline as imported social science approaches displaced indigenous approaches and as government-funded social service professionals began to shoulder aside neighborhood leaders. After all, according to the new dispensation, only trained experts know how to deal with complex, deeply rooted social problems. Neighborhood leaders can only amateurishly put band-aids on the symptoms, as the mantra goes. In Woodson's pithy description of the limits of social policy, the helping hand strikes again. But beneath the rusting hulks of failed social engineering projects, Woodson argues, there are hidden wellsprings of hope. If only we know how to look, if only we have eyes to see, within America's low-income neighborhoods, there are still, in spite of the contempt and neglect of the social service experts, neighborhood leaders who are working every day to solve the problems of their own communities. And because their efforts are rooted in and built around restoring the authority of local community institutions, institutions through which all Americans had once tackled their problems, these leaders enjoy quiet success. Those institutions are largely unheralded and severely underfunded, certainly by government, but even by the private charitable sector. After all, they usually occupy abandoned storefronts in the most forbidding neighborhoods. They have stains on their ceiling tiles and duct tape on their industrial carpeting. They have no credentialed staff, certainly no professional fundraisers or slick promotional brochures. Furthermore, more often than not, they're moved by a deep and compelling religious faith. They are convinced that human problems can't be solved by social and psychological rehabilitation alone, but call instead for fundamental spiritual transformation. Indeed, many faith-based institutions are run by inner-city volunteers who were themselves once trapped in the problems they are now helping others to overcome in gratitude for God's mercy and in answer to God's call. For them, crucifixion and resurrection are not just inspiring religious metaphors, they are lived daily experiences, all too accurate descriptions of the depth of brokenness and despair they have faced, followed by the faint, hopeful glimmer of redemption. In the early 90s, we at Bradley asked Bob Woodson to come to Milwaukee to help us rethink our program of local grants. We had been told by all the experts that our central city, like most American urban cores, was nothing but a desolate wasteland, begging to be filled by well-paid professional service providers gingerly making their way in from the suburbs. So we challenged Woodson, show us, here in our own backyard, these invisible faith-based groups that you talk so much about. And so he did. Within weeks of his visit, we had met Bill Locke, the founder of Community Enterprises of Greater Milwaukee, a business incubator and job training center. We had met Leslie Handy, whose Professional Receptionist Institute was training women from welfare to clerical and receptionist jobs. We had met Cordelia Taylor, founder of Family House, a community-based senior care facility whose work has gone on to be featured by Reader's Digest, Oprah, and The Today Show. And we met and we provided for dozens of other neighborhood leaders who were indeed quietly and effectively doing what they considered God's work with no attention from the urban experts. Working with Bob Woodson, we began to develop the eyes to see what he saw. to see the fresh springs in the desert. It was with Woodson's eyes then that we came to see the work of Pastor Sedgwick Daniels. He had launched his church with eight families in 1986. In fact, he just celebrated this weekend the 20th anniversary of its founding with a service conducted by Bishop T.D. Jakes of Dallas. Even by the mid-90s, Pastor Daniels had built Holy Redeemer Kojic into a congregation of several thousand in his family's Northside neighborhood. The heart of the church was a massive community outreach effort featuring four schools, both public and private, a health clinic, a credit union, an assisted living center, job training and counseling programs of all sorts. Other than some funding for the schools, Pastor Daniels and his congregation were funding all this out of their own pockets. As we at Bradley heard more and more about him through our trusted neighborhood sources, we went out to see this remarkable church and asked him if he might be interested in receiving a grant from us. I know that's not usually the way foundations work, but what he was doing dovetailed perfectly with our efforts to help resuscitate the ability of local community institutions to tackle their own problems their own way. We went to him because we simply wanted to be a part of what he was doing. After several years of small grants for operating support, Pastor Daniels came to us with a larger request for some serious capital. Next to his church was a long-abandoned warehouse, which he proposed to buy and renovate for community use. The new facility, the Mother Catherine Daniels Conference Center for Community Empowerment and Family Reunification, officially opened in August 2004. It includes two schools, one public and one private, a boys and girls club, an evening school administered by the local community college, and a conference and performing arts facility. Of the $15 million price tag for the effort, I'm proud to say that the Bradley Foundation contributed $1 million. This may well be the largest grant ever made by a secular American foundation to an inner city Pentecostal church. How President Bush himself came to embrace the idea of faith-based initiatives is another story that involves his own encounter with Bob Woodson. In the mid-90s, then Texas Governor Bush's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse threatened to cut off the use of food stamps by well-known faith-based recovery program Teen Challenge. Freddie Garcia, founder of San Antonio's Victory Fellowship and an ally of Teen Challenge, teamed up with Bob Woodson to stage a protest rally in front of the Alamo. Marvin Olasky, author of The Tragedy of American Compassion and editor of the evangelical news journal World Magazine, featured the rally as a cover story. Dakota's rules were soon reversed by Governor Bush, but not before the governor had invited Woodson to Austin to confer about the power of grassroots groups for solving social problems. Soon the governor himself was visiting local faith-based groups around Texas, talking about the need for governor to help mobilize for the government to help mobilize, but not to replace, the private sector's armies of compassion. Those visits to the smallest, scrappiest, most overlooked groups have continued during his presidency. As he tours the facilities, he invariably seeks out one young man who's been saved from drug or alcohol dependency. He quietly tells him that he too has been saved from alcoholism by his faith. For President Bush as well, crucifixion and resurrection are more than inspiring religious images. It's hardly an accident then that when Governor Bush pulled together some thinkers and writers to help him think through a social policy for his presidential bid, it should have included Bob Woodson and Marvin Olasky as other prominent thinkers in this area of faith-based initiatives. Shortly after the election of 2000, when the new Bush administration asked Bradley for advice about potential site visits in Milwaukee, we unhesitatingly pointed them to Holy Redeemer. Not because by then Bishop Sedgwick Daniels was a Republican. No one would be so suicidal as to be a Republican in Central City, Milwaukee. Rather, it was because no single institution better illustrated the themes of the administration's faith-based initiative than Holy Redeemer. Picture Tom Edsel attached to his article last month was taken on the occasion of that visit by the president to Holy Redeemer in July 2002, a full year before a single federal dollar had flowed to the church's efforts and 2 years before Bishop Daniels served as a delegate to the Republican Convention of 2004. Perhaps I'm being naive, but I would like to think that a handful of federal grants matters less to Bishop Daniels than the fact that the President of the United States had come to his neighborhood and had held him up for the nation to see as an exemplar of one of the central convictions of his administration, that local faith-based leaders know how to tackle problems that have baffled the social service experts and deserve consideration for federal funding. Without doubt, the argument cited by Tom Edsel that these groups would not be in existence were it not for federal funds is, in the case of Bishop Daniels, a gross misunderstanding and a profound insult. To be sure, the subsequent legislative fate of faith-based initiatives is not a pretty picture, and as even Edsel himself had to admit, the portion of federal funding involved is pretty paltry in the context of the overall federal budget. But I think the larger idea, the founders' intentions behind the faith-based initiative, lives on and may yet have a significant effect on American politics. For the faith-based initiative was, in a larger sense, an effort by our political system to come to grips with an extraordinary and wholly unexpected resurgence of spiritual energy in America over the past decade. The experts not so long ago had assured us that, in the words of theologian Harvey Cox, the heavenly city was about to be replaced by the secular city. But by 1994, in his book Fire from Heaven, Cox had to admit that he had been wrong. The explosion of Pentecostalism around the world, especially among America's urban minorities, he argued, had given the lie to the secularization thesis. By economic interest and historical experience, these minorities had, of course, long found a home within liberalism, the Democratic Party. So it came as no surprise that during the election of 2000, Democratic presidential candidate Al Gore formulated his own plan to accommodate their interest in faith-based social services. But the fit between re-energized spirituality and liberalism has not been an easy one. For one thing, at the heart of liberalism is the sprawling constellation of social service delivery professions. Indeed, between education and government service, these professions supply much of the funding and energy for modern liberal politics. But their professional status derives from training and credentialing in deeply secular social sciences. They don't take kindly to the suggestion that spiritual transformation may be a substitute for social and psychological rehabilitation, and they certainly don't relish the prospect of losing jobs and funding to faith-based programs. More deeply, the notion of God presents a challenge, shall we say, for the liberal intelligentsia, not because they're particularly atheistic, but rather because cutting-edge moral and philosophical doctrines raise questions about any form of transcendent truth. Prominent philosopher of the left, Richard Rorty, for instance, applauds liberal forebears John Dewey and Walt Whitman for arguing that there is no need to be curious about God because there is no standard, not even a divine one, against which the decisions of free people can be measured. Instead, they viewed America as an opportunity to see ultimate significance in a finite human historical project rather than in something eternal and non-human. Needless to say, the idea of a faith-based initiative fits poorly into a world where faith as such is viewed as delusional, but that view is common on university campuses and in the intellectual salons of the left. Jim Wallace, a prominent, if lonely, progressive spiritual leader, tells the story of a young man who approached him after a talk at a Boston bookstore. He told Wallace, "I'm gay, and I want to thank you for making me feel welcome tonight, but you know it's easier to come out being gay in Boston than it is coming out as religious in the Democratic Party." None of this is to suggest that there aren't, in fact, millions of deeply faithful people within the Democratic Party. It is to say, however, that it's hard to imagine a Democratic presidential candidate insisting that her favorite political thinker is Jesus Christ, as did President Bush, could do that without automatically disqualifying herself from contention for the party's nomination. And it is to say that there are, in fact, millions fewer serious religious voters within the Democratic Party since the exodus of northern blue-collar Catholic ethnics and southern Protestants in the wake of the turmoil of the 60s. While that had something to do with race and economics, It also had to do with the fact that this was precisely the time during which democratic liberalism openly embraced Rorty's idea that there is no standard, not even a divine one, to guide our politics and morals. The fact that millions of those Southern Protestants and Northern Catholics flooded into the GOP significantly changed the religious tenor of that party, of course. The genteel, understated Protestantism of George Bush the father gave way to the far more enthusiastic evangelical Protestantism of George Bush the son. This new religious enthusiasm within conservatism has been fed by the rise of the suburban megachurch, the latest evidentiary burden against the secularization thesis. Significantly, many of those churches are racially diverse and take seriously Christ's injunction to care for the poor through aggressive ministries to low-income communities. All these factors built a new conservatism that is highly receptive to the Pentecostalism of central city leaders like Bishop Daniels. This affinity may become most visible around highly charged cultural issues like gay marriage and abortion, but that should not obscure the deeper point that conservatives share with Bishop Daniels, the unembarrassed readiness to seek a divine standard against which our political and moral decisions should be measured. To be sure, some agnostic libertarians are to be found within the conservative intellectual leadership, but they are a distinct and increasingly frustrated minority. In a way that is simply unimaginable in liberal publications, the pages of conservatism's chief intellectual journals are filled with serious reflections about the nature of God, his action in the world, and his relationship to the American Republic. Whether conservatism will finally benefit more from liberalism than liberalism from the flow of new spiritual energies into American politics is still very much an open question. The administration's faith-based gambit was a somewhat disappointing opening effort. We'll no doubt soon see if liberalism can do better. Certainly, it will have an easier time negotiating the cross currents of race, economics, and history that bedeviled the faith-based initiative. But if I haven't made this clear yet, let me do so now. I want Bishop Sedgwick Daniels at my side within the conservative movement, not just because it will improve our electoral fortunes, though it will, but rather because it will improve the movement itself. The danger of seeking after God's blessing is that we occasionally persuade ourselves that we've earned it, or worse, deserved it. As critics have pointed out, conservative religious figures are from time to time guilty of that presumption, of concluding that their comfort is a sign of God's pleasure. As a result, conservatism occasionally presents a face that is indeed self-righteous and intolerant. The faith of leaders like Bishop Daniels and Bob Woodson, however, seldom ventures far from a firmly rooted understanding of the brokenness of the world, of the reality of crucifixion and the desperate need for resurrection. It is a faith that is earthy, modest, and realistic. It would never permit us to forget our obligation to care for the least of these. For in the final analysis, they would remind us, each of us, from the president on down, that we are the alcoholic taking his first faltering steps to sobriety in the loving arms of the storefront faith community and of the God it incarnates. With that humbling, holy truth at its heart, conservatism could not fail to be a blessing to America. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to just throw out some provocative ideas about the role of religion in politics from 24 years studying the civil rights movement. Civil rights movement was a citizens' movement of faith-based people growing out of the Southern Black Church. Nobody expected it after World War II, the next great social movement to come out of a Southern church and out of an invisible culture, and to be a nonviolent movement with nonviolence as its core tactic. Gunnar Myrdal's epical study of race in American Dilemma does not mention the word nonviolence. It calls upon America to confront the race problem, but doesn't call on faith-based citizens' movement, nor predict one. And if somebody did predict one, they wouldn't have predicted that it would have erupted over the seating order on the back of a bus. So I think we're united here in the notion that citizens' movements, faith-based citizens' movements, can be a great and should be a great and transformative element in American democracy. To me, the major difference we have here is the spirit that comes out of that, and whether or not the civil rights movement is a really good model of the kind of transformation that we can hope to achieve through faith-based citizens' politics in a democracy. I just want to mention a couple of things that have struck me that I don't see a lot in public discourse. Number one, Martin Luther King speaking for a movement that he didn't create, it really created him as kind of its orator and spokesperson, spoke about religion and politics every day, often 5-6 times a day in sermons. He had many enemies. He had people who wanted to kill him from the time of the bus boycott. He had governments that were wiretapping and harassing him. He had supporters who were patronizing and saw him as a simple, turn-the-other-cheek Baptist preacher, not schooled in the ways of the world. He was roundly criticized by the Washington Post and the New York Times for not knowing what he was doing and being out of his element. And at the same time, his own staff was pulling him in a dozen different directions so that his world was a crucible. And what's remarkable to me in looking back at this whole intense record of 54 to 68, his short career, is that I can't find one single instance in public papers in which his enemies, critics, or rivals, or anyone else, criticized him for mixing church and state. At a time of politics now where the whole notion of a faith-based initiative or that sort of thing sets off resentments and fights over the proper role of church and state, or whether to throw the church out of politics, or this, that, and the other. It seems to me surely an instructive generalization that Martin Luther King's whole career heading a faith-based movement was about the principles of politics and faith, but he approached it in a way that never touched off a debate about the role and the proper mixture, or partisan debate, even for that matter, of church and state. And I think it's because of the way he did it. He didn't try to subdue one or the other. Most people who talk about church and state are trying to get God out of politics, or they're trying to subdue all of politics to some particular idea of God, and they set off friction. King talked about equal souls and equal votes as a common underpinning of our secular and our spiritual heritage that opens a politics that is far beyond liberal and conservative, that goes to the core of what democracy is. Never pretended that liberal and conservative was a whole philosophy as opposed to one wing on our eagle of state. The discipline, the conservative discipline and self-government that it took to be a freedom rider and to be nonviolent in the face of people that wanted to kill you, was all of the disciplined conservatism that most people in the movement could handle. And the faith, the public trust, which was the other half of James Madison's great definition of what makes American Revolution such a great experiment in human history, that all our political experiments rest on the capacity of mankind for self-government, but also that if men were angels, no government would be necessary, and that no form of government can secure liberty without virtue in the people, are beautifully and incandescently combined in a civil rights nonviolent training that governs oneself collectively and individually, and yet looks in the eyes of your own oppressors trying to figure out ways to establish new common citizenship. That's just what the Founding Fathers did. They confronted hierarchy and oppression and converted it into common citizenship, and that's what the civil rights movement did. And because King talked about church and state in such a an ecumenical level, he avoided all of the pitfalls that we normally get when we start arguing about a church and state. He put one foot in the scripture and one foot in our constitutional and patriotic documents, consistently in balance in his rhetoric. That's why the Gettysburg Address sounds like a spiritual document, even though he's talking about a casus belli at the end of the Civil War. King had that same quality. Second thing that's notable to me about the civil rights movement as a faith-based citizens movement that is often not regarded that way is that we do not claim it to this day as a model for democratization in the way that it was described at the time. We tend to try to reduce it to something that was small and esoteric. It still has enormous resonance. That's what happens when Rosa Parks dies. We know there was something significant there, but it has not been studied or adopted or taken as a model for democratization that can inform all of our time. As Dr. King predicted, the blessings from the civil rights example of democratization and a citizens' movement trying to inspire our politics to be an instrument of freedom flowed far beyond the end of terror and segregation for Southern black people. Far, far. I mean, for one thing, it liberated the white South. That's what he said it would do. You never heard of the Sun Belt when it was segregated. It was the hookworm belt. It wasn't even fit for professional sports or business until the national government eliminated local segregation laws that had been entrenched for a century. And as soon as that happened, the mayor of Atlanta said, "We built a sports stadium with money we didn't have on land we didn't own for a team we hadn't found," and brought in the Atlanta Braves, the first of the major Deep South sports teams, and the Miami Dolphins created. But far, it liberated not just the Southern economy, but Southern politics, which had been a one-party, ossified, democratic system to support white supremacy. And through the federal government, bringing in 3 million new black voters, it created the first two-party competition, the first healthy politics in the South, destigmatized Southern white politicians so that now they can become leaders of both national parties, which they really couldn't do before when they were stigmatized by the stain of segregation before the world. But far beyond that, for women, for immigrants, the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, which deracialized the people that we invite into our country. Pauli Murray, I like to cite, as a great hero for women. She had been excluded by my university, the University of North Carolina, in an official letter saying, "We don't accept students of your race." She was turned down by Harvard Law School in an official letter saying, "We don't accept students of your sex." She persevered anyway, was one of the few people to criticize Martin Luther King for not having no female speakers at the March on Washington. How can a self-consciously and avowedly struggling freedom movement over equal citizenship exclude females? She asked. Just a few years later, she noticed, in 1966, when a civil rights worker was murdered openly by Klan workers and a Catholic priest shot in the back and hospitalized for more than a year, in the open, right outside the courthouse in Alabama, and the killers were acquitted within 30 minutes by an all-white male jury. Pauli Murray filed a lawsuit against the Alabama state law that excluded all females from jury service in the state of Alabama. Civil juries, petty juries, grand juries, they couldn't serve on juries. The League of Women Voters in Alabama said this was not a priority for them. They didn't think that women should really be worrying about serving on juries because there was a lot of offensive language that you would hear in trials, and they didn't think it was appropriate. The prevailing Supreme Court decision in that time, Hoyt v. Florida, upheld a Florida law that said if you were a female in Florida and you wanted to serve on a jury, you couldn't unless you affirmatively went down and took the initiative and filed an affidavit saying, please consider me for jury duty and it won't interfere with my homemaking duties. That's how stratified this country was. She filed that lawsuit. It overturned the Alabama law and then swept through over 20 other states that severely restricted the right, including several others that completely banned females. We have a hard time even remembering that our country was undemocratic to that degree. We take for granted the blessings that have flowed far beyond the issue of Southern segregation from this faith-based citizens movement of the 1960s. Pauli Murray, of course, wasn't satisfied there. She was a deeply religious woman, and it ate on at her as she thought about the notion of equal souls and equal votes, the message that Dr. King was putting forward out of our spiritual and political heritage that still stands perilously in the world. She was haunted by the fact that females were restricted from the clergy and most of the American faith-based systems. And she fought, and at nearly the age of 70, after going to seminary, she stood as the first female ordained Episcopal priest in the first group ordained officially by the church, 1976. And there was a huge schism in the Episcopal Church. A number of bishops didn't recognize this ordination, saying that the Bible preserved authority in church governance for men. And a number didn't recognize her. But then that faded away, and now we accept female Episcopal priests as part of our spiritual tradition. There had never been a female rabbi in 2,000 years of rabbinical Judaism until the civil rights movement got people to struggle over what equal votes meant. And the first female rabbi was ordained in 1972 in the United States. This spirit of democratization went all around the world. It was in Berlin when they sent, it was in Gdansk in the solidarity movement, faith-based. They sang "We Shall Overcome" at the Berlin Wall. And in the Velvet Revolution in Prague, that nonviolence as a tool for democratization by enhancing strength through politics has become a model for the world. Certainly Nelson Mandela, most of us never believed that we'd ever see anything but Armageddon in apartheid South Africa. He comes out of a life sentence, 27 years in prison, and instead of retribution and violence, without one shot being fired, calls for reconciliation, truth and reconciliation in a biracial democracy. Even Tiananmen Square was inspired by American nonviolence. There have been rebellions in China for 5,000 years, but never one before modeled on the sit-in of nonviolent students, introducing the seed of freedom in the authoritarian shell of Chinese communism. They haven't won yet, but they haven't been forgotten either. So, we do not claim the full benefits of the civil rights movement for spreading liberty and new democracy in the world. We take those benefits for granted. I think part of it is because some of us are still uncomfortable with essentially studying a black-led, faith-based freedom movement as modern founding fathers who did just what the founding fathers did, to confront hierarchy and convert it into new forms of liberty. Instead, we have tended to resist and diminish the democratization of that period with the prevailing idea of national politics since then, which is that government is bad and that this is kind of a politically correct straitjacketing of politics rather than a liberation movement that many of us with daughters or with black friends take for granted as a blessing to the world. There are a lot of reasons that this happened, but and many of them are chargeable to the movement itself, because the civil rights movement rejected nonviolence toward the end. Dr. King became lonelier and lonelier, and there are lots of other reasons why this happened in the Vietnam era. But nevertheless, with the benefit of history, we have to see that religion and politics can be very compatible and liberating for democracy. I just want to mention two other things as to why that I think are seldom discussed, and I'll do it briefly, and they're very controversial. Roe v. Wade occurred, handed down, as you know, in 1973, at just about the time Sally Jane Persan, the first female rabbi, was ordained. There were no women in the U.S. Senate at that time. There were very few female theologians, female clergy of any type. This was a very significant thing generationally and subliminally in American politics because democratization and a lot of the other faith-based citizens' movements that the gentleman mentioned, the abolition movement, the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement before, had a unique blend of the voices of prophetic justice. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, and the sensibilities of women in harness to enhance democracy with citizens' movements. Roe v. Wade and the abortion issue drove a wedge between religious voices and women's groups who were interested in the empowerment of women. It happened at a time when women were just beginning to exercise and demand equal citizenship. And this wedge has, to some degree, separated the voices of the church from the voices of women. It would be very interesting and a signal development in modern America if women's groups and women's theologians and women's clergy were to get together today and discuss the abortion issue as an issue of both politics and religion, as an issue of unwanted pregnancies that in some senses is an issue inevitably of at the heart of democratic theory as well as moral philosophy. Democratic theory in the sense that every unwanted baby is to some degree a failure of self-government at the individual level and writ large is necessarily a threat to self-government as the archetype principle of democracy. But conditions have changed, the condition of women, in other words, what I'm saying, the condition of women in the clergy have changed dramatically and in politics since Roe v. Wade. And it would be very interesting to see how they look now in a new generation where women are active and hold positions of authority not only in politics, but in every field of religion and every denomination that we know except the Southern Baptist Convention, which I think has just thrown them out again. The last thing I want to mention having to do with religion and politics, and I'll throw this out, it's also sensitive. For a century, Jewish intellectuals, spiritual and secular, were the yeast in a lot of the American public discourse over the role of democracy as an instrument for social justice in the world and how that could happen. The Six-Day War in 1967 was a transformative event in shifting a lot of Jewish discourse in the world from the reliance on principles, alliances, idealistic thought to reliance on violence and the state for natural reasons. That Israel survived by defeating five Arab armies and all of a sudden the notion of muscular David as the key of reliance was reborn. That has had an enormous effect, but largely unrecognized, I believe, on our whole perception of idealism, religious justice, and the issues of violence and nonviolence, and whether our strength is in our values, as the civil rights movement said, when confronting fear, we shall overcome by trying to lift our values, or whether our strength is in giving up our values We have to have wiretaps, we have to have violence, we have to have torture, because that's where our real strength is rather than in our values. That's a major divide in politics and religion that's not really being discussed very much right now. So these are very, very basic issues, and the only thing I would say in conclusion is that it's remarkable and sad to me that the civil rights movement is not more widely studied and applied in advocacy groups as a model for how faith-based citizens' movements can introduce new democracy that changes and liberates the everyday conditions of life for people far beyond the groups that they were struggling for as their named clients. Thank you.
We do have a few minutes for questions, and it is our practice that if you want to make a comment, you may make it. You don't have to disguise it as a question. You can make it, but please keep it very brief because we do need to move on with this sequential program. So we have a lot of very provocative ideas on the table, and I would invite anyone to pitch out the first question. Yes.
Thank you so much. My question is for Minister Branch. You mentioned about using the model of nonviolence from the civil rights movement, and you touched on just a few brief reasons as to why that hasn't been studied and applied. Can you maybe just expand upon that? Because just hearing you speak this morning just really made things gel in my mind as to the real power and the value that religion can have in politics. And I'm just really struck this morning as to why this isn't used and applied and studied more.
Well, it's a mystery to some degree, but I think that it's a painful historical truth that nonviolence was the most powerful change agent unleashed by that generation of faith-based citizens' movements. But it was also the first idea to become passé within that group and rejected across the board, most enthusiastically by white intellectuals, by the New York Review of Books, people like that thought black power and kind of a more revolutionary stance was sexier and that sort of thing, and notwithstanding the fact that it generated a lot of noise and no progress, we've been frozen in that attitude ever since. One underlying reason for it is racial, which is that nonviolence wore down because a lot of its practitioners were black, and they felt that they were expected to be nonviolent because they were black, to reassure white people that they were safe. And so one of the things that was striking to me that I chronicled in this last book were the pained conversations going on behind the scenes. Why does America admire nonviolence mostly in black people? And how can it be fair that the people who have been the victims of segregation and injustice should be expected to seek out further sacrifice to get people to do what they should have done in the first place? And Dr. King would always say, there's no answer to that. I'm not saying that it's fair. What I am saying is that nonviolence is a leadership skill that has you, in which we're setting an example for the whole country to bring, to lift the rest of the country up. But what happened was that was a hard argument to sell to very young people who were going to jail for a long time, and eventually they said, no, we see nonviolence as a handicap of being black, and the right to be violent like John Wayne or James Bond as our maturity. We're going to step forward and claim the rights to be tough and mean like everybody else. And we've been frozen in that rather it's compelling psychologically, but historically and intellectually it's fraudulent, and we're still stuck in it. So, I think that it's a sad thing. And, of course, a lot of people also did not, the nonviolent movement was threatening to a lot of people. It was distant. People didn't know about it. Columnists didn't write about it. I mean, if America was transformed by 8-year-old girls in Birmingham marching into dogs and fire hoses, and it changed the partisan structure of American politics. You know, that's worth thousands of PhDs. We see PhDs written all the time on some minor form of a new attack ad that may have changed a Senate race or two. But that form of nonviolence was so far away from conventional politics because it was faith-based and because it was citizens that we've really kept hands off from it. So I see that as a sadness.
I know it's not my question, but if I could, I wonder, and actually it's sort of a follow-up question to that question to you, if I may, and that is simply this. To what extent do you think the neglect, and I think you said the study of the movement has been neglected, to what extent do you think that neglect is a result of a sort of a problematic fit between the sort of theoretical understructure of the disciplines and of the academic modes of study and a faith-based movement itself? I've often found, you know, secular scholars to be very it's not as easy for them to see the power of faith, even when it's expressed in a kind of a political way. Because they're coming to the issue with certain modes of knowing that regard that as a form of superstition, to put it bluntly.
I think that's probably fair. I think the fact that it came out of a black community and it came out of a faith-based community puts it, and it came out of young people. We're not even comfortable with the notion that young people can be. You know, the first sit-ins were treated in journalism as panty raids because people couldn't get their idea around the notion that young people could be moral pioneers in confronting injustice with nonviolent, you know, faith-based tactics. So, I think that it's alien in a lot of respects, and therefore not part of our public discourse.
Yes.
You know, I think both of you have given compelling examples of how how faith-based work can make a very constructive contribution to our society. But I'm wondering if you would want to comment about, especially in light of the founders and the reason that they consciously built into the Constitution the separation of church and state, and their motive in doing so, is there also any danger or misuse or potential destructive consequence of an increased involvement of faith-based work in politics?
I think the answer to that is both easy and quite difficult. The founders were concerned about established religion. You have to understand they were at a time when basically the government said of each state, or most states said, you have to belong to a certain church, and if you don't, you can't vote. That's established religion. And the interesting thing is that since then, we generally accepted the notion that mixing church and state as a matter of establishment and using political power to promote one version of religion or another is not only politically dangerous, but it's religiously dangerous. It essentially makes public acts into idols. I mean, in religious doctrine, you're creating an idol out of something if you say this is the embodiment of what we believe through politics. That, to me, is part of the genius of Martin Luther King, is that he created no religious idols and he created no political establishment in trying to summon up people to live out a juncture of their, where their political and spiritual ideals met, and that's what's going on in these faith-based based group. So, yes, obviously there is danger in establishment, there's danger in mixing church and state, and a lot of terrible things have been done in the name of religion. You know, that's what we're fighting in, that's what we're fighting in terrorism, is a political application of a religious dogma. So we don't want to do that, but it requires, that's why the study of American history and the study of how you separate these things, and but how you can draw on them at the same time, what it makes me sad is that we don't really study civics very much, not just as part of American life. We think democracy is just, you know, something we take for granted. To me, it's as broad as philosophy and as deep as religion, but it grows out of our history, people trying to figure out how to get the best out of both.
Yeah, I would, certainly all sorts of terrible things can be and have been done in the name of religion, without a doubt. But if you look at the founders' solution to that, I think if you in Federalists number 10 and 51, what you find is nowhere do you find any sort of radical skepticism about faith. What you find is a way of trying to permit people to have their preferred faiths, but figure out ways to soften the impact on politics. One of the primary ways, of course, was the this was to be a commercial republic, right? We were, if you look at the Constitution, an awful lot of it concerns trade and commerce, and there's a reason for that. You know, the impact of commerce on faith was to be a softening and a kind of a moderating influence of commerce on faith. And so you find in America a form of faith that is by and large not as heaven directed as possibly faiths in other parts of the world. The multiplicity of sects, of religious sects. They assumed that in a large commercial republic, not only would the sects be less zealous, but they would also be so numerous as to cancel each other out across this very large commercial republic. And indeed, I think if you look at the history of American politics and religion, you find that their predictions for the softening effects of both commerce and the multiplicity of sects has by and large been borne out. And that's all before you begin then to get into the situation of the separation of powers and all the other sort of diluting methods that the founders undertook. But at no point did they think that it was possible or desirable to eradicate the religious foundations. And in fact, as you well know, many of the founders believed, not necessarily the primary founders, but many of the secondary founders believed that virtue was very much a part of the founding and that you needed some kind of religious foundation for it, albeit not a state church.
I'll take one more quick question. Yes, yes, ma'am, or back here.
Hi, my question is for Mr. Chambra. I think we all sort of have seen recently the Democrats struggling with how to talk about faith in a legitimate way. And what I feel like I hear you saying, and please correct me if I'm misinterpreting, is that from the left, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to have a legitimate discussion of faith. And I just wonder if you could comment on, is there a way for the left and the right to discuss governance and civil society within a framework of values, or does the Democratic Party just have to stay completely out of it, religion-wise?
Well, no, I think the crucial, I think for the Democratic Party in particular in its relationship to faith, and incidentally, I commend to your attention the latest issue of Nation magazine, which has three articles on this very issue. It's how can the left come to grips with faith and faith-based political conversations? They just find it very difficult. I think that's just going to be an extraordinarily difficult thing for liberalism to do, to come to grips with that conversation around faith, for reasons sort of spelled out in the magazine and in other discussions lately. And this is, as I say, it's not a particular animus against faith. It is an embrace, though, of a view about truth that is fundamentally anti-essentialist, anti-foundationalist. There is no real truth. There is no ultimate truth. And so, as Richard Rorty says, why even bother speculating about what God might wish for your, you know, for your political ventures? That's just going to be, for Democrats, that's going to be an extraordinarily difficult conversation, I think, to have at that level. And the interest groups that are sort of gathered around a secular point of view on public policy, those interest groups are pretty powerful and have a very strong grasp on the party. On the other hand, as I say, there are cross currents of economics and historical experience, the experience of the civil rights movement. All of those things make the Democratic Party a kind of a place of welcome for people people of faith with liberal views. But how all that plays out is going to be a problem. And as I say, my preference is to bring people like Bishop Sedgwick Daniels into the conservative movement, simply because conservatism is better for it. It is more rooted, it is more grounded, it is more realistic. It has a real heart for the low income and the least of these, and I think that's an extraordinarily important element for conservatism. Any American, incidentally, should wish that to happen. You don't want the country divided, as you suggested, into a conservatism that's simply mean-spirited and comfortable on the one hand, and a liberalism that's oriented to social justice. You want to find some way to introduce powerful notions of social justice into the conservative movement, and I dare say that the embrace of pastors like Sedgwick Daniels is one way to do that.
I think that our panelists have certainly answered a lot of questions. They've raised a lot of questions, and I think both would agree that we need to get this potentially volatile mix between religion and politics right, in some ways, for the preservation of our constitutional democracy. And I think they would both agree that we ain't quite there yet. But I want to express my appreciation to these two panelists, for Taylor and for William, for Bill, for coming and helping to enlighten the path as we, as a nation, continue to address these issues. Will you please join me in expressing our appreciation to them for their presentation? Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Hey. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
How you do?
Thank you very much.
All three of us.
Okay.
We got a picture.